Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests, and in this sense, not just native intelligence. John Kiriakou, someone who worked for the CIA, it's the official intelligence agency, and I kind of like to see what I do as sort of an alternative view of intelligence, certainly about foreign policy. At least I'll let the listeners know everything I know. Nothing is redacted. But I've done a bunch of these. In fact, John Kiriakou was one of my first on the show. We've now been doing it for 5 years. And I wanted to talk to him just about more than anybody else about, you know, the U.S. retreat from Afghanistan, one of the most absurd adventures. And he has not been asked to be on a single one of those talk shows, not on MSNBC, not on CNN. You know, this whole crap about the free media, and we have the progressive side on the MSNBC and the right-wing side of Fox. Here is the one person in this country who you can actually say knows more about what happened in Afghanistan, how we got into it, and really knows more about Iraq and everything else, because he had access to all of the official files working in the CIA and has not been asked to be on a single show of, you know, dealing with what was it all about? Why America's longest war, and coupled with the other, you know, endless war in Iraq, which is still not over. So just to give a quick brief background, John Kiriakou was, he's of Greek parentage, and he learned Greek as a child and everything, which was helpful. The CIA is always interested in foreign languages, and he was at George Washington University and had a guy who was a former CIA agent who was his professor in graduate school and recommended him that he go to work for the CIA, and he did. And he was there for, you know, what, I guess 10 years before 9/11?
A little bit, yeah, 11 years.
11 years.
Almost 12.
And working there and working on many different things. And he learned Arabic, and he traveled throughout the Mideast and was one of really the most knowledgeable people about that area of the world. And I'm going to let him tell the beginning of this story. But I do want to give people sort of a punchline right away. John Kiriakou is, I think, to this day, the only U.S. government official that has been punished for our torture program. Not because he tortured anybody, but because he revealed to ABC that we had a torture program. And am I correct, John? Has anybody been?
You're absolutely right. So I'm the only person who's been prosecuted who had anything to do with the torture program, and my role was to expose the torture program rather than to actually torture anybody.
Right, and you served. You got a 3-year sentence, and how long did you serve?
Yeah, I got a 2.5-year sentence, and I served 23 months.
23 months in prison. And yep. And here's this guy, by the way. Let me just give a couple of high points. You were involved in the capture of what at the time was thought to be the highest Al-Qaeda figure, Abu Zubaydah. And you were with Zubaydah after he was captured, and when the FBI, which was very good at interrogation without torture as opposed to the CIA, they were sent in an expert, and you got really a lot of useful information from Abu Zubaydah without torture. And then they brought in the torture guys, and it all went haywire and useless. And a future head of the CIA was one of your superiors who approved it, you know. And you could go through the whole story. Just let's take it from beginning. This is a major part of American history. And your accounting of it, even though MSNBC and Fox and CNN don't care to talk to you, you really know more about what happened with the U.S. in Afghanistan and also Iraq, because you were on that desk at one point. Just, I'm going to shut up now, and please just tell your story and what you learned about it and what the lessons are. And I don't care. Sure. You just keep going, and I'm not going to interrupt you from now on. Okay?
Okay. I joined the CIA in January of 1990. Spent the first 7.5 years as an analyst on the Middle East. I learned to speak Arabic. I served overseas in Bahrain, in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia, and I got bored. So I made a very unusual switch to operations, specifically to counterterrorism operations. Served in Athens, which was a critical threat for terrorism post. And then when 9/11 hit, I volunteered repeatedly to go to Afghanistan. Finally, I was sent to Pakistan as the chief of CIA counterterrorism operations there. And in March of 2002, I led the raid that captured Abu Zubaydah, who we thought at the time was the number three in Al-Qaeda. He wasn't the number three, but he was a very bad man. He was responsible for creating and staffing Al-Qaeda's two training camps in southern Afghanistan. He was the founder of Al-Qaeda's safe house in Peshawar, Pakistan, called the House of Martyrs. And he was Al-Qaeda's de facto logistics guy. If you needed a false passport, you went to Abu Zubaydah. If you wanted to get into Afghanistan across the border and you didn't have papers, you went to Abu Zubaydah. So we caught him, and he was the highest level capture to date, right? From 9/11 until March of 2002, he was the toughest guy, the highest ranking guy that we had caught. And he was sent to a secret prison. Its location has been reported in the media, but the CIA still will not allow me to say where it was. And the FBI began interrogating him. Now, the FBI is very, very good at interrogation. The FBI has been doing successful interrogations since the Nuremberg trials. So they knew what they were doing. And Abu Zubaydah was providing actionable intelligence. This is intelligence that was actually disrupting attacks and saving American lives. But the CIA was very frustrated because it was the FBI that was leading the case. You have to remember, too, that 9/11 was still an open criminal case. And that's why the FBI was in a leadership position, even overseas, where the CIA is usually in a leadership position. So the CIA got frustrated, and then Director George Tenet asked President George W. Bush to throw the FBI out of the country where the secret prison was and to let the CIA take over. For whatever reason that nobody has ever explained, President Bush did that. The FBI withdrew from that country, and the CIA took over the Abu Zubaydah case. Now, within hours of taking over, they began torturing Abu Zubaydah. They began using these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques that had been approved by the Justice Department. I should back up, though, and say that several months earlier, I was asked if I wanted to be trained in the use of these enhanced interrogation techniques, and I said no. I said that I had a moral and ethical problem with it, besides the fact that I thought it was patently illegal. We have very specific laws in this country that prohibit us from carrying out these torture techniques, but the CIA did it anyway. Now, here's where the big lie was. The big lie was that these techniques worked. The techniques never worked. What happened was the CIA and the FBI hated each other so much at the time and refused so adamantly to work together that their computer systems were incompatible. So the FBI was able to gather this actionable intelligence from Abu Zubaydah, and they reported it back to FBI headquarters in their own channels. The CIA was not receiving those reports. So when the CIA began torturing him, even though the torture didn't work and Abu Zubaydah just clammed up, he went silent, the CIA contractors took the FBI reporting, retyped it in CIA channels, and said, "Look what he's told us. The program is working. Look at the intelligence that he's giving us. It's just flowing out of him." And so they were able to keep up this lie for years, even until after the torture program was officially over. Now, this program went on for years, and it wasn't just Abu Zubaydah that was tortured. It was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the mastermind of the 9/11 attack or attacks. It was Ramzi bin Ashib and Abdurrahim al-Nashidi and other very high-ranking Al-Qaeda members. They were tortured at secret sites around the world. They were tortured at the Salt Pit Prison Center, torture center in Afghanistan. They were tortured at Guantanamo. And finally, in December of 2007, I got a call from Brian Ross of ABC News. And by then, I had been out of the CIA for 3 years, 3.5 years. And Brian Ross said that he had a source who told him that I had tortured Abu Zubaydah. I said that was absolutely untrue. But it led me to conclude that his source was at the White House and that they were going to try to make me the fall guy because I was the only one who was opposed to torture. And so I decided to tell Brian Ross the truth about the torture program. And in early December of 2007, I gave this interview in which I said three things. I said that the CIA was torturing its prisoners. I said that torture was official U.S. government policy. It was not the result of a rogue, as President Bush had said. And I said that the torture policy had been signed by the president himself. And so the very next day, the CIA reported me to the FBI for leaking classified information. The FBI investigated me from December of 2007 to December of 2008, and then concluded in December of 2008 that I had not committed a crime. They closed the case. But then 3 weeks later, Barack Obama was inaugurated as president, and he named John Brennan, an old colleague and nemesis of mine from the CIA, to be the Deputy National Security Advisor for Counterterrorism. John was also one of the founders of the torture program. And so John Brennan, in January of 2009, asked the Justice Department to secretly reopen the case against me. I had no idea that for the next 3 years, my phones were tapped, my emails were being intercepted, and teams of FBI agents were surveilling me. And then in January of 2012, I was arrested and charged with 5 felonies coming out of that ABC News interview and a subsequent interview I did with the New York Times. I was charged with 5 felonies, including 3 counts of espionage. And that's when the fight started.
So, and one of your superiors went on to be head of the CIA and was deeply involved in the torture program, right?
Yeah, that was Gina Haspel,
yeah,
who we called Bloody Gina because of her penchant for torture. Gina Haspel liked torture. She actually flew out to the secret site just to sit there and watch a torture session. Now, there's no reason to fly halfway around the world to just watch a man be tortured. That's a sickness. It's a mental illness.
What was being
done?
But
we called her Bloody Gina Haspel in the CIA.
When was that? When was she appointed head of the CIA?
She was appointed head of the CIA in 2017. And I'll tell you a funny sideline there. The day that she was appointed, I got a call from the Washington Post. And they asked if I would do an op-ed for the Sunday Post because they knew of my opposition to torture, of course, and assumed correctly my opposition to Gina Haspel's nomination as CIA director. So I wrote this, and they gave me a ton of space. I wrote a 1,200-word op-ed. And that Sunday morning that it ran, I got a call from Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, a Republican of Kentucky. And he said, can you come up to my office so we can strategize about how to block this woman's nomination? I said, absolutely. So I rushed up to Capitol Hill, and he had a whole team of people there and whiteboards with senators who were opposed and senators who were for and senators who were undecided. And we did this strategy all day long. And then a week later, when it came time to vote, he voted yes. And, you know, we saw that with so many Democrats.
But he's a Republican, yeah. Okay.
He's a Republican. Yeah. But we saw it with so many Democrats who you would think would have been the core opposition to a nomination like Bloody Gina Haspel, and then who just sort of folded. and ended up with no principles whatsoever.
You know, interestingly, Dianne Feinstein, a senator from California, was really very pro-CIA. And until the committee that she was chair looked into it, and the CIA went after her own people, her own staff people, and she finally released the introduction to the report. We've never been able to read the report, though, from the Senate committee.
No, and that's an important point, Bob. You know, so many people think that the CIA torture report was declassified and released. It was not. What was declassified, and it's not even really declassified, it's so heavily redacted that you can barely follow it, was only the executive summary, right? The executive summary was 400 or 500 pages, as I said, heavily redacted, and that's what was released to the public. The 5,000-page report was never released, and in fact, there are a limited number of copies, something like 14, and many of them have already been destroyed. So there's a chance, really, that no one will ever know what was really in that torture report.
You know, interestingly, even in the barbaric Soviet Union, Khrushchev revealed some of the crimes of the Stalin era. That was the beginning of change in the Soviet Union, the end of communism in Russia, really. And it's interesting. We all, because of a popular movie that was made and so forth, we all think that there was actually a Senate investigation, which there was, and it seems to have been quite thorough. And we know the CIA tried to crush it and actually undermine the chief investigator. That's what the movie's about. Yes. But most people don't even know any of this happened. But most people think Dianne Feinstein acted heroically, at least getting a report out. But the fact is, in this democracy, we've never been able to see the report. We've never been able to read it. And it would be a crime if somebody gave it, say, to a journalist like myself, right?
In fact, it would be espionage. It would be a violation of the Espionage Act. Right. This is one of my big disappointments on Capitol Hill. You know, after I left the CIA, I went to work on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for 2.5 years under John Kerry. And I never saw people work so hard to keep information from the American people as the staff members on those big committees, intelligence, foreign affairs, or foreign relations, and armed services. They don't want people to know the truth. Feinstein has been one of the biggest disappointments because for so many years, she was really nothing more than a cheerleader for the CIA. She supported, for example, Steve Kappas, the notorious deputy director of the CIA, John McLaughlin, the even more notorious deputy director of the CIA. She, in fact, demanded that that Kappas be named deputy director. Again, these guys are in up to their necks in the torture program. And it was only when John Brennan ordered CIA officers to hack into the Senate Intelligence Committee's computer system so that he could see what exactly Feinstein's people had gathered that finally made Feinstein flip. And she finally went after him. Now, Feinstein reported Brennan to the Justice Department for committing a crime, and Brennan reported Feinstein to the Justice Department for committing a crime, and Eric Holder decided that he wasn't going to do anything for either one of them, and so there was never an investigation. But this is what we're up against. We're up against these titans of politics and government who just don't want the American people to know the truth.
Well, it is Orwellian. And I know that's an overused reference, but the fact is, it's the continual search for enemies, the exaggeration of enemies, and then developing a neat mechanism for destroying the freedom of the American people in the name of fighting that enemy. In 1984, you don't even care about what you name it, if you just find one. And the war on terror came at a convenient time. We've always had terrorism, and we always will have terrorism. When people don't have airplanes, they'll use somebody else's civilian airplanes as a weapon of terror. They don't have armies. Whatever's driving them, whether it's a form of insanity or their own religion or their own fanaticism of some sort, so they make civilians the enemy. And so do we now with the drone program. But the irony is the Senate Intelligence Committee that she was head of, wasn't that set up in response to the findings of the church committee, right?
Oh, a good point, Bob. Yes, you're exactly right. The only reason we have Senate and House Intelligence Committees is because of the crimes that the CIA and the FBI were committing prior to the establishment of the Church Committee in the mid-1970s.
Yeah, Senator Frank Church, yes, who was a great man.
Great man.
Yeah, and so here was Dianne Feinstein, head of the committee that's supposed to be holding the CIA accountable, and most of the time she's just defending them mindlessly, but then she finally gets this report, and it's supposed to be a victory that we get to read a heavily redacted part of the introduction rather than this, as you say, 5,000-page report. Right. I want to make one little, I promised I wouldn't interrupt too much, but there's one thing I want to mention. You mentioned Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as one of the people who was tortured. And there's now going to be a lot of examination by historians and everybody else about why did we go to Afghanistan? What was Afghanistan all about? And of course, the 9/11 attack. And the key architect, for people who don't remember or never knew of this, was all supposed to be Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, ironically, a man who went to college in North Carolina.
That's right.
And kind of liked the United States at that time. And so I've always been curious, how did Khalid Sheikh Mohammed get to be this fanatic who wanted to destroy the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and so forth? And so I carefully read the National 9/11 Commission report that had been appointed by the president by George Bush. It was supposed to be bipartisan and so forth. And in that report, they very clearly say they were not allowed. This is the bipartisan committee on 9/11. What was 9/11 about? And they had the highest level of clearances, and they're appointed by the president, by George Bush. And they say in that report, there's a disclaimer. And in that disclaimer, they say they were never allowed to interview the people that were accused of doing this, including the most important being Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And what they were only allowed to do was put questions through the people who were doing the interrogation, torture, right? And get some responses from them. So, and they had to then write the report based on the information basically given to them by the torturers. But they never got to talk to the people accused of the crime. I have never understood why that is just sort of passed as a footnote to American history. And here, you know, what would Khalid Sheikh Mohammed have said if there was a trial? You know, there were a Nuremberg trial. You could find out what the Nazis said. Why have we never been able to hear from these terrorists? And you are one of the rare individuals that actually was involved in not the torture, but in the interrogation of one of these people. What does anybody even ask you about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or what happened? What was that all about?
Rarely. I'm only very rarely asked about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And, you know, just to add to what you've said, everything you've said is true. It's a historical fact. But the 9/11 Commission was not allowed to interview the CIA officers who had dropped the ball in the hunt for the 9/11 hijackers and for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. None of them were interviewed. Inexcusable. But Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is a fascinating figure because...
First of all, how many times was he waterboarded? Is he still alive or what?
He's still alive. He's still awaiting trial before a military tribunal at Guantanamo. And every once in a while, a statement will leak out through one of his attorneys saying that, well, recently he had said he wanted to plead guilty, and then he changed his mind, and then he said he didn't do it, and then he said that if they don't execute him, he'll give the details of the planning, and he's just all over the map. But he's all over the map because he's largely lost his mind. at Guantanamo. Between being waterboarded 147 times and undergoing other unspeakable tortures, things worse than waterboarding, he's just not in his right mind, as many of these Guantanamo prisoners are not in their
right mind. When you say
worse
than waterboarding, you were in the CIA. You know, we've kind of, you know, and we always accept everything as, and under this rubric of American exceptionalism, when we do torture, it was a mistake, maybe an accident, it'll never happen again. Fact is, we tortured people in Vietnam. It's one of the reasons why, you know, the Pentagon Papers were at issue, the RAND Corporation, where Tony Russo and Daniel Ellsberg were working, and that's where they're the ones who whistleblowed, who leaked those or took those papers to the New York Times. The fact is, the RAND Corporation was going over the interrogation of Viet Cong prisoners in Vietnam, and that's what turned Tony Russo, who was one of the people reading those reports against the war, because the people he was reading about, the statements were from people who were tortured. It was the torture program of Vietnam. That's way before the torture program that was in Afghanistan or Iraq. Right. You know, and but we have short-term memory, and we think, oh, well, torture, it happened. But, you know, no, we are one of the main propagators of torture as a legitimate weapon of inquiry.
Yes. Yes, we absolutely are. And we pretend to be this shining beacon of respect for human rights and human dignity. And it's just simply not true. You know, when I say that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others underwent torture that was worse than waterboarding, I'm serious. I'm not exaggerating here. There were other techniques, things like, for example, sleep deprivation. We know from the American Psychological Association, which has studied this extensively, that people begin to lose their minds at around day 7 with no sleep. And when I say no sleep, Bob, I mean you're chained to an eye bolt in the ceiling, so you can't sit or lay down or get comfortable in any way.
And Gina Haspel knew all this and maybe even witnessed it?
Oh, yes. 100%, with 100% certainty, she did.
Gina Haspel saw, or would she have actually seen somebody chained in that way?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's what was happening at the secret site. Yeah, chained to an eye bolt in the ceiling so you can't get comfortable. Bright lights, like military industrial strength lights, on 24 hours a day. Music blasting on a loop, just being repeated over and over and over again, 24 hours a day. After 7 days of that, you start to go crazy. At day 12, you start to die. You know, people begin undergoing organ failure with no sleep. And the CIA was authorized to keep people awake for 14 days, beyond the point of death. That some people suffer. That was one technique. The other was called the cold cell, where, again, you're chained to this eye bolt in the ceiling, and you're naked, you're stripped naked, and your cell is chilled to 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and every hour a CIA officer goes into your cell and throws a bucket of ice water on you. We killed people with that technique. So there were techniques, certainly, that in my view, were worse than waterboarding. Now, with waterboarding, it's supposed to induce the feeling of drowning. In fact, it has made people drown. Abu Zubaydah had to be revived with CPR because he actually did drown during a waterboarding session. So these are techniques that were used that are not, you know, gray areas. Well, you know, maybe they're not torture. No. These are not just torture, but internationally recognized forms of torture that have been banned by treaty to which the United States is signatory.
Right, and I want to repeat that John Kiriakou, who I'm speaking with, is the one person in the entire United States government who was punished in connection with the torture program. He was not punished for torturing people. He was punished for revealing that we were torturing people to a member of the press, Remember, our Constitution says that the press is supposed to be free, and yet you spent time in prison because you dared to reveal that. None of the torturers have ever been held accountable. And I mean, it's a startling reality. But the thing that is often left out, and I want to get to, is the reason we were in Afghanistan. Well, not really. We went in Afghanistan to give the Russians their Vietnam, and that's a whole nother story. We were messing around in Vietnam before, and we brought al-Qaeda people to Vietnam. That's another documented reality here. The people who did 9/11, you know, the al-Qaeda people were not natural to Afghanistan. They were brought there as part of a recruitment to fight when Ronald Reagan called them freedom fighters. They were brought there to fight the Russians, and who were defending, by the way, a secular government in Kabul. But the reality is, we don't know what happened with 9/11. And then that brands you as, oh, you're a... I'm not denying there was this terrible attack, and I'm not denying that al-Qaeda was behind it. But the fact is, we know very little. It's like, again, I bring up Orwell's 1984. You know, you got an enemy. Okay, you don't want to know too much about the enemy. The one human being who, had he had a lawyer and a trial, we could have heard something from, was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And he clearly, by all accounts now, seems to have been the key figure. And the last thing in the world, evidently, the CIA and the U.S. government wanted was to hear from this guy. We heard from Nazi war criminals. We learned a great deal about the Nazis and what they did and what drove them and how to fight the Nazis. We learned a great deal from them. We have learned nothing from the inside of this terror camp. Nothing. And you were there. You were sitting in a room with, at the time, Abu Zubaydah, who was the top, they said was the top guy. Yeah. And you and an FBI agent actually got information from him. So what I'm suggesting is that maybe our government didn't want to know who these guys are and what drove them. Because Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was a guy who was thought to be even somewhat pro-American when he was a college student. He liked it here.
Crazy as that sounds. Yeah, that's true.
So how did he go from being this guy in North Carolina? And the others, you know, they seemed to like to go in Texas when they were there and go to strip joints and everything. Who are these terrorists? And what really drove them and so forth? We have next to no information, and we systematically destroyed the brains of and the bodies of people who could have given us some clues. We tampered with the crime scene.
You're absolutely right. It was my experience that we didn't really care what drove them. You know, our motivating factor was 9/11, and it was revenge. We didn't really want to understand why they did what they did. Now, it was clear to those of us who had interrogated, or in my case, it wasn't so much an interrogation as it was a conversation, a series of conversations with Abu Zubaydah. I learned why he did what he did. You know, Abu Zubaydah, I spent 56 consecutive hours with Abu Zubaydah, and I mean consecutive in the literal sense. I sat at the foot of his bed for 56 hours, and my orders were not to leave his bedside. And so I didn't. We talked a lot about 9/11 and about why he did what he did. And for him, you know, Abu Zubaydah is Palestinian. For him, it was U.S. support for Israel that motivated him to want to attack the United States. It was, according to him, watching news video of an Israeli soldier with his boot on the neck of a Palestinian woman as she was screaming for help. That's why he did what he did. Now, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was a little different. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was a true believer in Osama bin Laden, not just as a political leader, but as a religious leader, despite the fact that Osama bin Laden had no religious credentials. And bin Laden relied on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed because he was an expert planner. Remember, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the one who planned the Bojinka attack in 1996 that was thwarted, where as many as a dozen 747s were going to be hijacked from Manila and flown into buildings all up and down the west coast of the United States. That attack never took place. We didn't know Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's name. We knew only his nom de guerre, which was Mukhtar. And it wasn't until the FBI interrogated Abu Zubaydah that he kept talking about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And his interrogator said, "Who is this Khalid Sheikh Mohammed you keep talking about?" And Abu Zubaydah laughed and said, "It's Mukhtar. You don't know Mukhtar?" Well, that was a major piece of intelligence that we finally learned that Mukhtar was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who had been educated at North Carolina State University, right? With a degree in agricultural studies, of all things. The FBI got that. CIA torture didn't get that.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. Okay, so the fact is, torture is not only obviously inhuman and illegal by any decent standard, it also gets in the way of getting information. Now, the question is, and we're talking at a time when, you know, and it's interesting, General Petraeus, who I just read recently an interview with him in The New Yorker, where he said we should have stayed in Afghanistan. It was working. He still believes it was working. He still believes the surges were working. And ironically, he became head of the CIA, and he only had to step down because it turns out he had given his mistress not the information you were accused, which was supposedly the name of a ex-CIA person who wasn't even in on covert activity, but rather revealing the torture program that he had, but he had these black books that were the highest level of secrecy, the briefing books for the president of the United States, and he had it, gave them to his mistress, you know, who was also his autobiographer. It was convenient to have a biographer who's your mistress. And he got a slap on the wrist, and you got prison time. He didn't get prison time.
Boy, did he get a slap on the wrist. I want to emphasize some of the things that you just said, because I think that they're really important in the context of how these issues are approached by the government. On the day of my sentencing, David Petraeus sent an all-hands email. That's an email to every employee of the CIA everywhere in the world. And he said that John Kiriakou was sentenced today to 2.5 years in prison. This should be a reminder to all of us that oaths matter, he said, and that you will be prosecuted for not respecting your oath. 2 hours after hitting the send button on that email, he lied to two FBI officers in his office, saying that he had never given his adulterous mistress any classified information. He was never charged with making a false statement to federal officers, which, by the way, is a felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. And when they finally confronted him months later with the proof that not only had he passed his mistress classified information, he had revealed the identities of 10 covert CIA officers, and he had given her access to the black books, which are literally the most highly classified documents produced by the Central Intelligence Agency. And what did he get? He got 18 months of unsupervised probation, a misdemeanor. And at sentencing, the judge came down from the bench to shake his hand and thank him for his service to the country.
You know, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, you know, so let's say somebody from, you know, let's say Rachel Maddow is listening to this. She won't be. But let's say she's listening, one of the good people in the mass media. I think she makes about $15 million. A year or something. I don't know what.
And now she owns part of the company.
Huh?
Now she owns part of the company thanks to her most recent contract.
What is that? Tell us.
Yeah. In her most recent contract, she signed this super deal where in addition to her, I think it's $12 million that she makes, which is roughly double what everybody else in the industry in her position makes, they gave her part ownership of MSNBC.
Which is owned by?
Which is owned by Comcast, Universal, I believe.
We'll have to check on that. Are you serious?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So she's listening to this, and let's presume she's still a decent person and cares and so forth. How do you square this? That here's John Kiriakou, who served in prison, time in prison, for revealing, they claim, the existence of this torture program. And maybe, they say, reveal, because the guy said, do you know anybody in the CIA who knows about the torture program? And you gave him the name, a card of somebody you'd just spoken to who disagreed with you, who actually supported the program. That was supposed to be your crime. And you just said Petraeus revealed 10 names. I know another CIA director, Panetta, the former Democratic congressman, he had a ceremony over at the CIA where they had the Zero Dark 30 movie writers and so forth there, where they revealed the identity of the people, the Navy SEALs who had captured and killed bin Laden. One of the, you know, these are people who could then be targets for any terrorists around the world who liked bin Laden or worked for him. And yet he didn't serve any time. So here you have two CIA directors who are just let off, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. You know, you raise a very important point here, too, with regarding the mainstream media. I've been on all of the major U.S. news networks, MSNBC, CNN, Fox. It's been a long time. But they've invited me on periodically over the years. And I'm always on the defensive, because it doesn't matter if you're on Fox or you're on, you know, MSNBC. For the most part, it's going to be a pro-CIA interview. And the funny thing to me is only under Donald Trump did Fox finally turn against the CIA. And the real cheerleaders for the CIA are MSNBC and CNN. And I'll give you an example. I was invited onto this R.E. Melber show with Daniel Ellsberg. So Dan joined from San Francisco. I joined from Washington. Melber's in New York. So the producer called me a day in advance and said, how would you like to be introduced? And I said, oh, it's always either former CIA officer John Kiriakou or CIA torture whistleblower John Kiriakou. And they said, okay, how about if we just go with former CIA officer? I said, yeah, that's fine. So I go to the studio, tons of makeup that they put on. I get mic'd up. I'm sitting there. There's Dan on the other monitor. And they're taping it for later in the day. And he says, we're going to tape 30 minutes. We're going to use about 10 minutes. I said, great. He interviews Dan first, and then he comes to me and he says, we're joined from Washington by convicted felon and CIA leaker John Kiriakou. And I shouted, motherfucker, excuse my language. I said, I went over this yesterday with your producer. I said, if you dragged me all the way up here to play games with me, I am never speaking to you or your network ever again. And I pulled my microphone off. And he says, wait, 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 I'm sorry, please, please don't. And the producer runs in, I'm so sorry, it was just a miscommunication. And I said, don't ever, ever treat me like that again. So they mic me back up. Well, how do you want to be introduced? I said, we've gone over this. I said, make it CIA torture whistleblower John Kiriakou. So they did, but then they cut me down to 20 seconds. Out of a 30-minute interview, and they never asked me to come back.
And that was MSNBC? Or
MSNBC.
MSNBC, the great liberal hope.
Exactly.
That is just...
Well, let me add one other thing. And this is the reason that I boycott the Rachel Maddow show. Because on CNN, even before I went to prison, they identified me every time they interviewed me. They identified me as CIA torture whistleblower John Kiriakou. Fox News, from the day of my arrest, called me a whistleblower. Whistleblower John Kiriakou. MSNBC calls me CIA leaker John Kiriakou. And on the Rachel Maddow show, every time she mentions my name, she says, John Kiriakou, who styles himself a whistleblower. And so every time her producer calls, I say, I don't do the Rachel Maddow show. She's a tool of the corporations. She's a warmonger and a torture lover, and I am not doing her show.
Let's think about this for a second. We're going to run out of time. You got another, 5-10 minutes or so?
Sure.
Okay. Let's make this an hour interview then. We got another 15 minutes because we got to really learn this stuff. And again, you know, I'm guided a lot in my interviewing by what I need as a teacher. And I'm devoting my classes term to going, you know, examining Brave New World in 1984 and considering whether we're heading to a dystopian future here and lying. And you know, one of the big offenses of Donald Trump is he was so crude as to be ultimately ineffective, rude, crude. You know, I call him the sweaty armpit of American capitalism. He gave too much away. And the people like the Petraeus and Panetta and Brennan and Rachel Maddow,
yeah,
these are people who can make it, you know, all about manners, and their wit. And so forth. And yet, you know, she could see a human being hanging from a ceiling, being tortured, and somehow, oh, that's okay. You know,
yeah,
that's okay.
No problem.
And find a polite, civilized, concerned way to discuss it. Whereas Trump said, hey, I support it. Let's support them all. You know, so he's giving away too much. The fact is, it was Barack Obama who brought cases against whistleblowers, more espionage cases than anyone, right? Any president,
absolutely,
all the presidents before him. And Trump has had a shorter record. So let's really talk about the role of manners and partisan politics. And one way we've been able to cover up, you know, Barack Obama had a chance to have a Church Commission. He had a chance to really look seriously at what this torture thing was all about. And he said, yo, I'm against torture. It's not what we do. Well, it is what we do. We tortured Native Americans. You know, we threw their babies into the fire, for God's sake, even in California in the 19th century, well-documented, you know. And so torture's been as American as apple pie, for goodness sake. And if we don't recognize that fact, you know, and we don't recognize that we've been able to do, you know, barbaric acts on civilians, including the dropping of the atomic bombs and drone attacks and so forth. We don't really examine ourselves. And why do we go along with it? Why doesn't Rachel Maddow want to hear more, particularly now with the utter failure of this whole Afghan adventure? You're somebody who knows Arabic. You're somebody who's been in the region. You're somebody who's in the inside of all this. Why wouldn't, you know, MSNBC have you on instead of having all these ex-generals and people who are actually war criminals?
Yeah, well, and it's not just me. I'm actually one of the small fries. If you look back at people like Phil Donahue or Jesse Ventura, they both lost their shows on MSNBC because of their opposition to the Iraq War. A former colleague of mine, Brian Becker, was a regular anti-war voice on MSNBC. And then once we invaded Iraq, they decided he was too anti-war and he never went back on MSNBC ever again. But you turn on MSNBC or CNN or definitely Fox, and all you see is a parade of retired 3- and 4-star generals or retired deputy directors or directors of the CIA and the FBI. There's no room for a thoughtful anti-war voice on any of these networks.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, MSNBC is owned by NBC Universal News Group, which is a division of NBC Universal.
Right.
And so, you know, we're talking about mainstream media, corporate media, and all of them are, you know, whether it's Murdoch or whoever owns it, these things. But they hire people that act as if they're civil libertarians, they're feminists, right. They're liberals, right. They're enlightened. And Rachel Maddow certainly fits that bill and has a massive following of people who she thinks she represents enlightenment. Well, if you're really enlightened and you really care about an informed public, and you're talking about what was Afghanistan all about, how dare you not talk to John Kiriakou? And I'm not, you know, trying to float your boat or something. I mean, I just don't get it. You know, I mean, I can't complete a sentence in Arabic. I doubt if she can. You know, you know the language. Take us through it. You were in Bahrain. You were all these places. You were,
I spent most of my adult life. I spent living in the Middle East. I mean, I've recruited spies to steal secrets for the American government. I've proudly served my country. I was the victim of two separate assassination attempts over the course of my 15-year career with the CIA. And then on top of that, I worked counterterrorism issues at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as one of four senior staff members working for John Kerry. But for some reason, I just don't meet the qualifications for any of these news networks.
Well, and this is what happened to Daniel Ellsberg. Daniel Ellsberg had been in the first, he'd been in the Marines. Then he was in the Pentagon. He was a brilliant Harvard student. You know, Henry Kissinger used to try to take credit for Ellsberg being one of his students, and then he then tried to destroy him when he was working for Nixon. And we got to talk about this because, you know, you are. For my money, looking at it, trying to look at it objectively, the exemplary American citizen. You are. Come on. What are we talking about here? I'm not, you know. I don't claim it. I didn't work for the CIA and I didn't offer my services. I mean, I've always been a kind of a contrarian and a critic and so forth. But you are the good scout. You're the Eagle Scout. You're going to George Washington. And you already know Greek, and you know you have facility for language, and the CIA guy or ex-CIA guy, I don't know if they're ever ex, he's your teacher, and he says, right. Wow, and he recruits you. You were recruited out of graduate school to go work for the CIA, and you learn Arabic, and they post you everywhere, and you become an expert, and you're doing really well. You're honored there for 15 years. And what happens is you only become the bad boy from the good boy because you object to the torture program.
And, you know, one funny thing, too.
Let's not slough over that, though. People listening have got to understand. You were the Boy Scout.
Right. I was the Boy Scout. And I was talking about this to a good friend of mine who when I say good friend of mine, I mean really good. We were at the CIA together. He's a brigadier general in the Army. He happens to be a psychiatrist on top of it. We go to the same church. We're in the same men's group. We were talking about this. And I said, yeah, they really turned on me when I came out against torture. And he said, no, they didn't. He said, they turned on you when you were still inside. He said, when you came back from Pakistan, don't you remember? He said, they used to call you behind your back the human rights guy. And I said, yeah. He said, that wasn't a joke. It was 2002 that they turned against you. They just waited for the opportunity to really drop the load of bricks on you. That took 5-6 more years. But he said, in 2002, when you were the only one who wouldn't participate in the torture training, that's when they decided they were going to get you. And I never thought of it that way, but he was right. It started in 2002.
Well, so take us to that story, 2002.
Yeah, I came back from Pakistan in May of 2002, and on the strength of the Abu Zubaydah capture, I was promoted, I got a medal, I got a big cash award, and I became the executive assistant to the CIA's deputy director for operations. Major job. And in that position, I had access to literally everything that the CIA was doing around the world. And I was in the cafeteria one day for lunch, and a senior officer walked up to me and very casually said, hey, I'm glad I ran into you. I wanted to ask you, do you want to be certified in the use of enhanced interrogation techniques? And I had never heard that term before. And I said, well, what's that mean? And he said, we're going to start getting rough with these guys. And he was very animated about it. And I said, well, what does that mean? And so he described to me these torture techniques. I said, give me an hour to think about it. Well, I thought about it. I talked to another senior officer, and I went back and I said, look, this is a torture program. I think it's illegal. It's certainly immoral and unethical, and I don't want any part of it. As it turned out, they had asked 14 people, and I was the only one who said no. And it was funny, too. Weeks afterwards, well, not funny, haha, funny, sad. Weeks afterwards, I was passed over for promotion, and I went into the deputy director of the counterterrorism center's office, who was a friend of mine, and I was in a rage. And I said, what do I have to do to get promoted around here? I just captured the number three in Al-Qaeda. Do I have to capture bin Laden? Is that how I get promoted? Well, it turned out that the deputy director of the CIA heard that I had been passed over for promotion, and he promoted me. It's called a field promotion. But they passed me over because I wouldn't participate in the torture program. And I just never put two and two together until later.
But we have to, I want people listening to this to understand, you know, I tried to understand Germany. My father was from Germany and was a Protestant. My mother was Jewish. So I grew up, you know, born in 36. And I went back to Germany many times to try to figure out why these good German people, you know, my father had left Germany after World War I. But, you know, my relatives, my uncle was wounded at Stalingrad and everything. You know, how could they go along with the most barbaric regime? And here they were so civilized, and, you know, they were farmers, but they were well-read. I shouldn't say but, you know, they were well-educated and by such standards. And they, you know, they said, well, you know, you have to know how hard our economic situation was, or you had to know, or we were just following orders, or we never saw any Jewish people. And you had all these rationalizations. And Germany quickly snapped back to being one of the most respected nations, which it had been before Hitler. So you have this brief period, relatively, in German history, where they're the greatest barbarians in human history, modern human history. You know, well, I think of that often when I think about my own government. And it's what Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil, the banality of evil. And it's easy to focus on some primitive, you know, fanatical Muslim tribesmen somewhere in Afghanistan and say, oh, well, no wonder they do bad things. We're talking about the best educated people. And those other people of the 14, the other 13 who would go along with torture, they probably had doctorates or certainly law degrees or masters or something. And why wouldn't they challenge it? That is the really fundamental question to ask about all this. It's what David Halberstam wrote, you know, the title of his book on Vietnam, The Best and the Brightest. That war was not given to us by idiots or poorly educated people who didn't understand that China and Vietnam, but although they were both run by communist parties, would end up being at war, which they have been, and China had occupied Vietnam for 1,000 years, and the whole thing was all crazy to be in Vietnam as a block to China, and the whole thing was nuts. They knew all that. They still went along with it, and they went along with the torture of the Vietnamese that they thought was necessary. And the people you were dealing with were all well-educated, right? People and can carry on.
Yeah, these are all very highly educated, in most cases, Ivy League educated. You're right, sober, patriotic. You know, this is something I've struggled with. I've tried to address in my own books. These are people who, you know.
Your book, The Reluctant Spy, if people.
That's right, The Reluctant Spy. These were friends of mine. Our wives were friends. Our children played together. And here they turned out to be monsters. Monsters. Murderers in some cases.
Well, that's a point on which to end. The good guys is monsters, murderers, the best and the brightest. And, you know, I think there's only, what, a dozen copies of that torture report still around?
Yeah, I think it's about a dozen.
Yeah,
maybe,
and they'd
maybe
like to
fewer now.
They'll probably, they're good at it. They'll succeed in destroying those copies. And then they'll say any copy you find is made up or something. And we'll never get the story of torture. any more than we ever got the story of the genocide against American Indians or what the reality of slavery or anything, because we're good at many things. And one thing we're good at is whitewashing. We're really brilliant at it. And there's no sense of accountability ever. I'm going to get you back on. I've decided we got to do an oral history here. We got to do a book.
That sounds like an outstanding idea.
Yeah.
I just sent to my publisher my seventh book, and I would like to do one just for fun on my own next as number eight, but then I probably should do something serious after that.
Well, I'm certainly here, and I've already done, I think, three or four interviews with you. I'd like to put them all together, a book. Do I have your permission? Yeah, I guess so.
Please do. I think that would be so much fun.
Okay. Well, I don't want to have too much fun here, because we should really, you want to keep your humanity and think about these things. But, if you think about anyone you care about, any fellow human being shackled, tortured, and so forth. I don't care whether it's, a maximum security prison in the United States or in China or anywhere, you lose your own sense of humanity if you can't feel outrage about that. And what you're really telling me, and whether these people, the generals, the politicians, the newscasters, they've lost their sense of humanity.
They really have.
Yeah, they're not accountable.
They really have.
If they were accountable, John Kiriakou would be listened to. Instead, he's been made a non-person. And I, probably have more people who listen to me who watch MSNBC. Think of that the next time you do. Think about why John Kiriakou is not on those shows, challenging these generals, who and government officials who covered for torture. But that's all the time we got now. See you next week. Let me thank Christopher Ho from KCRW for posting these shows. Joshua Shear, who is the executive producer of the show and put me together with John Kiriakou, and actually, I think he didn't work with you, but he knew you, knows you.
The only reason we didn't work together is because the day he started, I almost got killed in a car accident, and I spent the next 8 weeks recovering.
Well, so that's, if you have another show, you might steal Joshua Shear from
that's
me.
That's right.
And, I want to thank Lucy Berger for doing the transcription, Natasha Hakimi Zapata, who writes the introduction. I want to thank the JWK Foundation in the memory of Gene Stein, who was a courageous journalist, for helping fund these shows. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence. Non, je ne regrette rien.